You are now listening to The Social Hour.
They're not PC, so if occasional foul language turns you off, then you have all been warned. This is the calm before the storm.
You know what my Lexus won't do? It won't start smoking meth and break into your house in 10 years and steal your goddamn PlayStation 2, motherfucker. All it's going to do is be gas efficient and have a good resale value.
Get ready for the social hour.
Live from Dice World Studios in San Antonio, Texas, this is the social hour. On today's show, comic book creator Dan Frega. And now your host, on his way to the White House to pick up the cocaine he left there, Deese Casillas!
Malam Keen, everyone. Welcome to the show. This is The Social Hour. I am Deese. Thanks for coming around, guys, for another episode. I know I have been absentee for a few weeks, but it is worth the wait. We have a great guest on today, comic book creator, artist, writer, director. He's done all types of stuff. Dan Frega is on the show. We're going to talk to him in just a second. Before we get into it with him, as always, go to deesecomedy.com. Check out everything going on across the network, live shows, dates everywhere. I'll be in the Northwest all this week, as you hear this, guys. Shows across Washington, Oregon, all kinds of places. So check out the dates on the calendar and the website. Also, big news, the special Not Your Cup of Tea is now available. You can watch it on our YouTube channel. All you gotta do is go to deesecomedy.com and go to the Not Your Cup of Tea link, and it's donation based, so you can buy it for as little as a dollar. You can go watch that bad boy. Leave a comment, like, subscribe, all that jazz. We appreciate everyone who's bought it so far and the great feedback. It's finally done. So it's out there. You can watch it. If you see me the live show, we're selling download cards too. So please watch it, support. Put a lot of time and effort into that, and it's good to have it out. So that is all, guys. I'm going to let you guys, we're going to get into it with our guest. Please welcome Dan Frega.
Out here in Macon, which is like the center of the bullseye of Georgia where we live.
Yeah.
He would be considered a martial arts god.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? In comparison.
Yeah.
You know, because, and that's the thing, LA, like you're saying, the dynamic, you have to have almost already have made it to get in there. Otherwise, you're a needle in a needle stack.
100%, yeah.
But when you go outside of it, you get to shine, you get to build, and they, have you heard that guy? Have you heard, oh man, that bit on blah, blah, blah. And it starts to, you know, bubble. And
yeah.
Then LA wants you to open for big people.
Yeah,
and then you get, you know.
Yeah, you can get those reps. That's, I mean, it was the best thing I ever did, you know, to get out of LA and the, it's because I mean there's a chain of clubs up in the Northwest. They're all over America now, but their original club was in Tacoma, and then they opened one in Spokane, and now they've got them in I think like six different states. You know, they've got like a dozen clubs. But I got in with them early, and they they just didn't have a lot of other people, so I mean I was kind of by default, and I was always at the club hanging out and getting spots. And then next thing you know, I'm featuring, I'm hitting their other clubs, I've headlined their clubs, and they just, now I get to work for them all the time, and that's a good credit. Try to get
it. So what, in the art form of comedy, from what I understand, at least the way a lot of people work, is that they work towards these, like, I'll just use examples because of, we know what they are. So like take Eddie Murphy Delirious, right? And we know it front to back, and it's like this thing, but I'm sure over time Eddie sculpted it.
Oh yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? So what I want to know, it's like I'm interviewing you and we haven't even done the show yet, what I want to know is, like, when you're out there doing your bit, there's a bit you do, but how often is it morphing into this isn't playing, this is, or I'm in this area and this plays so well, but over here it doesn't. like that shaping. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think that's part of like getting on the road and doing comedy in other areas. Cause there's a lot of comics I know that are insular and only do comedy in one area. And you're like,
they're like the local band.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, yeah. That's fine. But you know, it's like that's super specific reference about, you know, Central Washington is not going to play when you're in Atlanta, you know?
Right.
So you get on the road and you start doing shows and you realize what's bullshit. You know, what of your act is bullshit and what flies everywhere. And you also start to learn like, oh, you know, this area is a little more conservative, so maybe I won't do all my religious jokes.
Right.
I'm in Alabama, or like, right. maybe I won't do these jokes about Joe Biden when I'm in Seattle. Cause like,
right.
you gotta play these. You just have to like understand.
Yeah.
And me, I mean, I push them a little bit. Like I just filmed my special and it's called Not Your Cup of Tea. Because like, I'm going to push people a little bit. I'm going to make it, you know, I think you have to in comedy. But also at the end of the day, I'm like, we're just having fun. We're telling jokes, having a good time.
How often, like when you go on Netflix and you see like a comedian, they have like, you know, at least the ones that are have been around for a while, you see that they have like maybe three or four specials, right? And they are definitely different material over, let's say, 3 years, right? How often do you feel the need to change material? How often does the changeover happen? Is it constant?
I'm always writing new material. I've been in this problem for a little bit where I just filmed that was my first hour I ever filmed. And a part of it was because I wanted to stop doing that material. Cause some of it's very, you know, not dated, but stuff I've been doing for a long time.
Yeah. Where can I see it?
I'll send you a link after this. It's on my,
I want to see it.
Yeah. Right now I'm selling it on my YouTube, but like, I can just send you the link so you can have it.
I appreciate it.
We'll get off this. I just released it last week. I'm always writing new material and stuff like that. And I kind of wanted to get my next hour about the skeleton about done before I film this. But I'm kind of in this weird problem where I'm still touring and people are buying tickets to shows. So I'm like, I can't give you all of this new hour that's fucking in the weeds wild. I gotta give you some of the old stuff still, so you're like, you know, mix it in. So like, I know these hit, mix in the weird stuff, try to perfect it.
The new stuff that you implement though, how do you like test it?
I used to do a lot of open mics. That's kind of the one way. Now I'm on the road so much and doing so many shows that you kind of figure out your voice and how you can write a joke and what's going to work before it even gets on stage, you know?
Yeah.
And then also I'll just work new material into my sets. Like when I'm doing an hour, I'll be like, you spatter in a couple new jokes in between jokes, you know, work that way.
Play crowd a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've even had times where if the audience is fun and they're still wanting more after I've done my hour, I'll be like, hey, do you guys want to just hear, these are new jokes I'm working on, do you want to hear some stuff? And then I'll do like 20 minutes of just all new material and get like pure feedback. So
That's awesome.
You know, you just kind of start mixing it in and see what works.
Timing too is a trip, you know, like sometimes a joke, that pregnant pause with the unexpected, like what's his name? Harvey Kurtzman, Mad Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And there was I think it's called Comic Book Masters or something like that. It was a documentary from 86. And he had to describe what comedy is. And he said, it's slowly inflating a balloon and then popping it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of times it's the...
Right.
You know, like...
When's it going to pop?
Yeah, just that little pop.
Yeah.
You know, and timing. Yeah, timing is another thing. It's like a joke. The words of a joke and the story of a joke are all dependent on that.
It's
a trip.
Well, it's funny because I filmed this thing back in November and Just been working on, well, I moved, I was working on editing it and all this crap. But even since then, some of the material I filmed has gotten better, or I've changed wording, or I've changed timing and stuff. And I'm like, God damn it. But eventually you just, it's just cooked. You just got to do it. Yeah. You know, you're like,
well, and then at a certain point, it's got to become muscle memory, right? Like in a way. And but then when it becomes muscle memory, you don't want it to become lackadaisical, right?
100%.
So do you, you know Jim Steranko? The we talked about him.
Yeah,
I spent like 4 hours with him in 1995, just sitting in the lobby of a hotel. It's the first time I met him, and we were talking about magic. Because he was a former magician, a masterful one. In fact, wrote books on it.
Oh, wow.
And he's like, oh, show me what you got. And, you know, and I, as a kid, I practiced coin magic a lot. Mm-hmm. So I can do French drops and, you know, palms and like all the good business with coins. And I'm like going through it and I'm just trying to show him how masterful it is. And he goes, yeah, you're good. You're not great. And I go, what? He goes, you don't believe it, any of it. You don't believe any of it. You do it good, but you don't believe it. Mm. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, your French drop, you know, when you go and do it, it's perfect. The timing is great. But I don't believe that you believe you have the coin. And he goes, let me show you. And he does this French drop and he goes, this coin right here, it weighs a certain amount. And, you know, and I'm thinking he has it.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know, I'm thinking about what I could spend it on, what it jingles like in my pocket. This thing is so fucking real, but it doesn't exist. And you go, oh my God, like it's that little tiny spice that's up in here.
Yeah.
That like, you know, like I have a buddy, he was in a pop group. Was a big one, NSYNC, right?
Oh, yeah, okay.
And I'd gone on the road with them a bunch of times and was able to watch the show, the same show, over and over from like different parts of the stage. And I was just kind of like, because again, like I said, I like kind of observing the craft of things. And I said to him, I'm like, dude, you got like 500 fucking dance moves and the choreography, you guys are like a Swiss watch the way you guys move. It's like, how the fuck? And he goes, it's muscle memory. We do it so many times that we just go out there and our bodies do it, you know?
Yeah.
So when I think about like a comedian, especially those hours, it's like, it's choreography. And I just wonder if it gets to that point where it's muscle memory and such. You know?
Oh my God. Well, yeah. I mean, two things for that. One is like when I film my hour, I filmed two shows back to back. So we had two shows that night and I filmed them both and I edited them together. And what I realized when I did that is that watching them is that my movements on each joke is almost the same. When I'm telling a joke, I'm moving this direction. Both of them, I moved my hand this way on every joke. And I'm like, I knew it was kind of similar, but oh my God, it was almost like you could have almost overlaid them. And it would have been so identical. But there is that, and I've had this problem where you start to, you don't realize it, but it's almost like you're reciting a script instead of being in it. And I've had shows where I'm in the moment and I'm telling these jokes and I'm on stage and all of a sudden, and in my head, I'm thinking, why isn't this getting the laughs it should get? Why isn't this show going? And then I realize consciously as I'm telling jokes, I'm like, oh, I don't believe it. Like I'm not,
it's the Steranko thing.
Like I'm not, and it's hit me and I'm like, oh, or I'll be like, you're not smiling, you know, you're not like, hey, so, and then I'll like, you have to consciously change your vibe while you're telling these jokes. Cause you can't stop and be like, give me a second, you know? So, and then all of a sudden the show starts going better and you're like, oh, I gotta remember.
Yeah.
Like,
did you see the John Mulaney? Is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you see the one where he's talking about being in rehab and all that stuff?
Oh yeah. His latest one.
Yeah. So I was watching that one and thinking, this is all really heavy shit. And he's telling a pretty heavy story.
Yeah.
But his smile and his demeanor, and again, the timing, it makes it so light and hilarious. But if you take away all of the timing and the smiles and the body language, some fucked up shit.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. But he sells it, you know, he sells it with that. Well, and it's like a guy like what's his name? Anthony Jeselnik. I don't know if you know.
I don't know.
So he's a great comic. He's kind of a one-liner, and he's very dark though. He has very dark turns on all his jokes. But he's like kind of this like matinee good looks guy and very charming looking. So he just sells it. Because you know,
like Don Draper.
Yeah. So I mean, I think it's because of the way he looks and how charming he looks and this kind of like nice smile that he can say this horrific shit and just sell it. But if he kind of, you know, looked like emo and had, you know, just looked darker and more ominous, people would be like, oh, this is kind of this is.
Hey, does your wife have the same tattoo as your ring finger?
No, she does not. This was actually. My tattoo artist, my old tattoo artist, she would just put a black heart on me every time she'd do a tattoo. I've got a bunch of them. She'd put them wherever she wanted. Oh, that's so funny. You got...
wife and I, we both have these.
Yeah.
It's that,
maybe that's she'll funny. Get, I don't know. I had this before we got together, so.
Yeah, right on. You want to get into the thing? Like,
Sure.
What's the format? Like, do we just have a conversation? Do you have questions? Like,
honestly, it's exactly what we've been doing. Like I said, I've done about 450 of these. I think total prep time of all of them, I've done about 20 minutes combined. Like, I don't, you know, because the way I look at it is if I come in with, like, I got to do this, and this, it becomes stilted. Like, you know, I don't have an agenda on it. I just want to, is there people I want to talk to? And, you know, like I said, when I interviewed Joe Kelly and we talked most of the interview, we talked about motorcycles.
Right.
I found out he rode motorcycles. I used to ride. We started talking and like that's what happened.
That makes sense.
So like I'm sure we'll talk about what you do and what you have done. But I mean,
sure,
it can go anywhere. I don't, you know.
Right on.
It's just what it is. So I mean there's no FCC. You can do or say whatever you want.
Ask questions about that. Hold on a second, my wife is leaving. Hold on. There we go. All right, great. That was the other thing. I didn't know if it I gotta watch my potty mouth because I have one.
Not on this show.
I have four kids and they hear the potty mouth all day, every day.
Years ago when I had my news anchor who used to be on my show. She was also she's a good friend of mine, but she was my opener when I'd go on the road too. And I said something one day, she had some news story. I don't remember what I said. It was something about an abortion clinic. She had some story about an abortion clinic. And I made a comment and I stopped myself and I'm like, that might be the worst thing I've ever said. And she, not even missing a beat, she goes, no, not even close. She goes, not even top 10. I'm like, holy shit. Like, I gotta go back and look at the things I've said on this show then. Yeah. Because, so don't worry about, you will not say the worst thing that's ever been said on this show.
Cool.
But no FCC, do or say whatever you want. I don't edit for content, and I'll probably just put the intro and outro bumpers and put it up. It'll probably come out tomorrow. So
we're both wearing our Star Wars shirts.
Oh yeah. See? Yeah, it's my, look at that. I like that vintage. Yeah. Star Wars Sunday.
There it is.
You've been watching the new show, Ahsoka?
No. I saw the trailer and the volume was off, right? And it's the whole believe it thing, the thing we were just talking about.
Yeah.
So here's Rosario Dawson and she's like doing these moves with her lightsaber, but she doesn't look like she's fighting for her life. She looks like she's doing the thing, and I was like, there's no intensity or ferocity in this. But the long answer, the encrusted answer, Star Wars is dead. Okay, like the last good thing that I saw out of Star Wars where I was like, yeah, that feels right, was Rogue One. That's it. Like, I tried the Last Jedi, like I tried with you know, The Force Awakens. I tried and tried and tried. Clone Wars is great. I didn't like the prequels until this new stuff came out.
Yeah.
And it's a lot like, check this out. Being from SoCal, we ate a lot of burritos and tacos and things. And you would not catch me dead in a Chipotle, in any of those sort of spots.
Yeah.
Here in Georgia, I'm like, when are we going to go get some Chipotle?
Right, yeah.
Like, you know what I'm
That's
saying?
That's the best Mexican around.
Genuine. So, that's like for Star Wars, very much the same. The prequels, I didn't want anything to do with those. I thought they were, you know, some guy, brilliant guy. He took all three of the prequels and cut them up into 1 2-hour movie.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think
right.
Yeah,
that movie was awesome. That great. Like now there's 4 Star Wars movies. Like Rogue One, there's 5.
Yeah,
great. But yeah, Mandalorian didn't hit me the way it hit a lot of people.
Same.
I don't know what the new TV show, not the Ahsoka one, but wasn't there one in between?
There was Boba Fett, and there was Obi-Wan, and there was Andor.
Obi-Wan, I didn't even want to watch at all.
Yeah, it was. I try to watch all of them because, you know, I'm that age, so like I'll give it a shot. The Andor one, I remember I was on the 3rd episode, I started it, and I looked at it, and I had this thought, I go, I don't even know what this guy's name is. And the funny thing is, I found out later, his name is Andor. It's the name of the show. And I'm like,
I thought Andor was a place.
That's what I thought too. It's the guy. And I'm so,
wow. I am so out of it.
Yeah, that's when I knew. Well, I had that same problem when I was watching the third movie of the new trilogy was, The Last Jedi maybe, or whatever it was. I was in the movie theater watching that, and I had the same realization when they had like the main characters on screen, you know, and I'm looking at him going, I don't know what that guy's name is. And he was one of the main 3 characters. I'm like, I've watched the other 2 movies, I've got this far, and it's left that little of an impression that I don't know what one of the main 3 characters' names is.
Right.
So
that's a big fault. But then the flip of it is, I've got a 9-year-old, and I tried to get him to watch A New Hope a couple years ago.
Yeah.
He won't watch it.
Yeah.
He says it's too slow, that, you know, it's boring, you know, and you're like, oh, but I get it. You know,
it's
like
a generational thing, you know.
Yeah, I'll watch some movies from the 40s, you know, but then again, they were trying to, you know, His Girl Friday, they're trying to fit as many words as they could.
Yeah.
And, you know, hey, blah, 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 blah. That real quick patter, you know.
Yeah, it keeps it going. Well, you know, I mean, they were afraid they're about to get wiped out by a bomb any minute. They had to, like, we got to get this done as quick as possible.
Right. the bomb.
Yeah, I have a buddy he's, you know, 10 years younger than I am. So he came up when the prequels were kind of, that was his Star Wars movies. He was the kid when those were like coming out. And to him, he's like, no, to me, those were great. Because again, that, like, your kids, that was his Star Wars. The part of the thing, my biggest problem with him, and this goes back to, again, the believe it, like we keep going back to, but when I watched, I think it was The Mandalorian, when I tried to watch that, everything is filmed in digital, high quality digital, and it's so shiny that Boba Fett's armor doesn't look like armor anymore. You can tell it's plastic, and you can tell everything's filmed on a sound screen instead of in Tunisia, where they, you know, like where they on location. So it all looks so fake because it is so fake, you know, like when you filmed on actual film, you could hide the imperfections with the grittiness of the film, you
and
know?
It's a warmer vibe.
Yeah. It just looks, you know, I mean, anytime you're like, the human eye picks up imperfection when something looks too real. It's the same reason like AI freaks us out, because we're like, that looks real, but we know deep in our head, we're like, that's not real, you know?
Right.
I think so. That's what happens in too many movies for me now. Same with Marvel and stuff, where it looks better than real life, and it might. I'm like, you know, you can't look better than my real life looks.
They've ruined that for me too. So
yeah,
you know, yeah.
Yeah, as a coming up as a comic book guy, is that hard? Why, like, watching those movies and thinking like,
well, coming up as a, well, it's just a weird thing. I mean, we could talk about the, you want to talk about this sort of stuff on the show, or are we on the show?
Like, mean, I've got it recording. We can, you know, I can edit in. I can drop in anywhere. So
yeah, great. Yeah, no, my whole thing with it, and it's one of the things that is really strange is, especially growing up, like, I think I might be a few years older than you. How old are you?
I'm 41.
Okay, I just turned 50, so okay. I am the almost the you to your friend. Yeah. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, so, because I saw the original Star Wars when I was 4, so that is definitely my Star Wars. Yeah. You know, New Hope, and I saw, you know, Jedi on my 10th birthday. Like, that's my cut. You know what I mean? So, but like, one of my buddies and I, we were talking on his live stream about sweet spots and whether or not it could be the time you grew up in or whatever. We grew up in the 80s was a super sweet spot, but I feel like it's quantifiable with Dark Knight, The Watchmen, Beta Ray Bill, the death of Jean Grey. You know, like, all of these things and all of these comic book personalities that came out of the 80s, you know, and but even more so these great stories that have been crafted during that time that are now proliferating our whole pop culture experience as a you know, as humanity.
Right.
Or at least people that watch movies. The problem, though, is that it's much like a banana. There's a really great time for a banana. It's like when it's green, you know, and it's almost turning brown. It's perfect, you know, and it's the same banana, but eventually turns brown and mushy. And the only thing it's good for is making banana bread or giving to your bird.
Yeah.
The thing that's really weird, though, is in that time, in 1989, which was, like, for me, my favorite year, is the year Batman movie came out.
Yeah, yeah.
You could go into a comic book store, pick up a John Byrne, Barry Smith, Walt Simonson, Art Adams, Neil Adams, Dale Keown, Rob Liefeld, Tom McFarlane, Jim Lee, Mark Silvestri. They were all on the rack at the same time.
Yeah,
right? Like, talk about what just the most beautiful comic book experience. But when you told people, well, you were into comics, they looked at you sideways and thought you were a weirdo.
Yeah, it was, right? Like a stigma back then.
Yeah, yeah. So there's this sort of thing. And now it's like all the way over, like the pendulum has swung over to where everybody, people that don't even like comics, are wearing Marvel t-shirts.
Right.
You know, or you know, have seen the movies. And it's great to see a lot of these things come into fruition. But much like the banana, would, like, take the Marvel movies for my personal taste. After
Infinity.
Yeah, after the Infinity stuff kind of wrapped up, it didn't feel the same anymore.
Yeah.
Like, Doctor Strange, Captain America 1, you know, First Avenger, Winter Soldier, and the first Doctor Strange to me are like, holy smokes, these are fucking beautiful movies.
Yeah.
But then Doctor Strange 2, it turned into this, like, what the hell is this? You know, and it's like I told my wife, because my 12-year-old, she was the perfect age when Frozen came out.
Sure, yeah.
And Frozen was wonderful. That first one was wonderful because it was organic and everything that happened was new and fresh and you saw these characters develop. When they came out with that spring whatever, that short, where one of them has a cold or whatever, the characters knew who they were to the audience. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and
then
suddenly it turned into the Frozen, haha, remember this gag? And
yeah.
You know, and like they were like playing up on the things that were organic with the first batch. Well, that's what it starts to feel like, where it's like, oh, let's, now that people are on board, let's force fit this sort of thing in. And like, all authenticity and all sort of believability and all of that nostalgia is gone because you've used up the magic. You don't know how to keep the magic going, so you're trying to recreate the magic with with whomever's own ideologies, and it just sits flat for me.
Yeah, it starts to feel, well, I mean, part of the problem too is like with all this stuff, well, there's a couple things. One of them is there's no such thing as an original idea in Hollywood anymore. They just take anything and then fuck it out, beat the dead horse forever to try to squeeze anything out of it. I mean, what did they say? So in the last like 7 years, something like almost 85% of the movies that come out are remakes, sequels, franchises. Like there's no original movies anymore. You know, everything's. But also, these things are owned by. I mean, you took it. Marvel's owned by Disney. DC's owned by Warner Brothers. You know, so these things can't be what Alan Moore or Frank Miller or these people envision them to be, because they're owned by a corporation that has to shoot straight down the middle. They can't veer too far right or too far left because they have to make it palatable for everyone. And right. So, you know, they want to make a comic book that, or a movie that can appease to everyone, even make sure it can play in China and stuff like that. Which, so it's like, you're not making something that really is innovative and has like a unique take. You're just making something like, there's an old saying, like, it's neither fish nor fowl, you know, like it's just nothing at that point. You know, you're like, it's like at least take a hard
view. It's smeat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, it just becomes, it just goes like, and it's nothing. It happened, but there's nothing to it.
Right.
And that's, I think, a big part of the problem too. Whereas if these guys could really take an idea, you know, and go hard genre. Like I always talk about like the New Mutants movie they made, which they kept gearing as like, oh, it's going to be this horror movie. And then it just kind of came out and was just kind of like a movie. And I'm like, if you would have actually gone full horror into that, you probably leaned into it. You probably could have had like an interesting movie, but you can't, you can't do that.
Yeah. Like, you know? If they had done the Sienkiewicz, all the, you know, the Clan of the Cave Bear, like all of that business, and kind of stuck with that, you know, visual style. Like the thing that I feel was a, like a victory for comics was the Into the Spider-Verse.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I felt like that really married the idea of live action animation and comics, and really they were able to get these sort of comic book vibes across in a very pure way. And I even enjoyed the second one. There's some stuff in it that I didn't care for, but like I enjoyed the second one, and there are certain storytelling innovations. And I think, you know, people, those movies, for lack of a better phrase, took risks, you know, what if people think this is weird? What if they, you know, they don't like it or whatever, they just did it.
Yeah.
You know, and the idea of authorship, like you said, it's an interesting thing, and it's an interesting time in comics. It's an interesting time in creation of everything, whether it's comedy, whether it's music. The same thing that's happening in movies is happening in music. You know, I go to the gym in the mornings, and they always play, you know, this Planet Fitness station, but it's still music. And I heard this song that came on from The Weeknd, and I'm like, I know this song. And then I realized it was a song that I had storyboarded in 2003, right?
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, wow, they're already remaking a song from 20 years ago. and I think, well, yeah, they remade songs in the 90s and whatever, but it seemed like every other song was either a remix of an old 80s or early 90s song, or a remake of a song that has happened in the last 25 years.
Yeah.
And then anything that's original, they tend to go like, love or hate Post Malone. When he came out, he had a unique style that set him apart. Same thing with Juice WRLD.
Yeah.
Same thing with XXXTentacion. These guys had a sound, but then like 10 other acts grabbed that vibe, and suddenly the landscape of music just sounds like this.
Right. Yeah.
And you go, man, like it happens in comics too. Like during that conversation with Andy Smith, we touched on the topic of like comic book superstars, mm-hmm. and like, or the comic book rock star. The first one was Steranko. He was kind of the first guy to pop. People liked Kirby, and but I'm talking like, oh my God, like who was the guy who did this?
Yeah,
it was Steranko. Then you had Neil Adams, right? Those guys popped. Then you had Byrne, Frank Miller, Walt Simonson, Art Adams. But then the guys that really cranked it up were the Image guys, yeah, the Liefelds, McFarlanes, Jim Lee specifically.
Yeah, like, I mean, those, yeah, they're in Levi's commercials,
right?
And shit like,
right,
that.
Yeah, and those guys were megawatt, and they made super impact. But I feel like after they did what they did, whether on purpose or not, the publishers made a concerted effort to never let that happen again.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, because if you think about all the awesome guys, and this isn't discounting any of my peers because I love them all, but the shiniest beacons, the absolute shiniest of beacons that came out of my era, the Joe Madureras,
yeah,
the J. Scott Campbells, Humberto Ramos, even guys, Lee Bermejo, none of them, as awesome as they are, not a single one of them. The closest was Stephen Platt, right? But none of them did that, and it hasn't happened since the 90s.
Yeah, that's escape velocity. Never really to get out of like the system, I guess you'd call it.
Right,
never really
and part of that, like I said, whether it was intentional or not, part of that I believe had something to do with things, but. What's great about right now, this time, and where you and I are participating in it right now, is we have the tools and the platforms to do it ourselves. So these risks, these movies that we want to see may not be on the big screen. They may end up being on somebody's YouTube channel. And the way to make content has changed. You know, I've always been into the visual medium and wanted to be a filmmaker since I was a kid, but there was a lot of economic hurdles, a lot of technological hurdles. And I remember in 2006, I saved up my money to get this really nice camera. It was a Panasonic DVX-100, right? Mm-hmm. And it was like, you could make broadcast quality stuff on it, but it captured to tape, it digitized to tape, but you had to light it like film. So you still needed lights and, I was really into the concept of green screen and doing compositing and creating environments using compositing. And I remember doing all this sort of tests of like where to put the lights, how much light, all of the f-stops, like everything to get that perfect comp.
Yeah.
So you dial that in. You capture it, then you have to digitize your tape to be able to go onto a computer, take that into something like After Effects, and then use the chroma key software to see if all of that work worked. That was like a process of about 4 hours to see if it works. Okay. That was 2006, 17 years ago. All of that I can do instantly with my phone.
Yep.
I can shoot it. I can actually do comping in app if I needed to clean it up outside or whatever, export, like everything is here. So a lot of those hurdles for people that are still storytellers at heart are being knocked down, and now we have the wherewithal. Like another anecdote in that category, because I've seen the talent levels out there go up, there's a bit of homogeny to it, but the talent levels are up. I had this storyboard artist work for me on one of the pilots I was working on, and she came in and she showed me her portfolio, and I said, man, this one was really good. And she said, oh, I did that when I was 16. And I was like, wow. When I was 16, I couldn't even think on that level. I said, there were no books and there was nothing that I wouldn't even know how to get there.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, well, what did you do? And she's like, oh, I watched YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, like that's massive, because coming up, I had How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way.
Right.
Figure drawing for all of its worth, and Bernd Hogarth's, you know, dynamic figure drawing. That was it. And you know, to learn any color theory, you had to go to the library. And I grew up in a small town, so my library had nothing.
Yeah.
So that, you know, we kind of learned our way that way. So, but anyway, the homogeny, though, is that everybody's watching the same stuff. And,
oh,
and
yeah.
Like, so I have a buddy, really, really amazing, talented, incredible artist, incredible teacher. His name is Dave Finch. And he's done amazing work. He's an incredible talent. And he teaches people how he does what he does. But what I have started seeing in like younger guys' stuff, and even some other guys that are out there working, is this proliferation of this Dave Finch
style.
And it's like, I go, oh my God, like another fucking Dave Finch looking dude. So then I have to like break things apart and really not analyze their style per se, but look at their storytelling.
Right. The composition
the compositions and how they work me through a page, because everything else I could tell was like, I don't want to minimize it, but this color by numbers sort of like, here's your figure, here's your light source, here's how you render it, you know, here's how you push a gesture. Dave is good at teaching all that. And it comes from an authentic place. Dave learned that stuff by grinding his way through it. And now it's kind of like trailblazing, you know. Lewis and Clark, they went west, they had to fight all the bears, they had to know where all the, you know, savages, quote unquote, were,
find the water sources,
where the water was, where to camp, where not to camp, and they blazed trails, and the people behind them just went, oh, all you got to do is follow those marks, so don't go there. And the next thing you know, there's highways, and now it's not even a consideration. Dave is a trailblazer, but the homogeny that comes doesn't help the craft necessarily. Every now and then I meet someone who's a deep diver who will go, well, where did Finch get his lighting concepts from? Right. And then you find that guy and you go, oh, well, where did he get his from? And then you find Frazetta, then you find, you know, Alex Raymond, and then you start find Al Foster, and then, you know, and you start to dissect it, and then you can make those decisions yourself and then express in an authentic way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've never thought about that, because like you said, if you go on YouTube and you can find everything, which is nice because it opens up, I mean, you know, you have access to, you know, manga and these other things, that so many other types of style of art that maybe when you were coming up, you couldn't hop on the internet and find all this different art that was coming out in different parts of the world. But now, also when everyone sees what's popular, they just kind of follow that, where people like you were probably forced to have this minimal idea and then create your own style around it.
Well, I want to touch on something on YouTube real quick. YouTube is powerful. YouTube saved me $800 by switching to Geico. No, they saved me $800 because I had a problem with my AC in my car, and I could have taken it in and spent $800 to find out that it was the resistor and that it's a $5 part, and I just have to go up under here, pop these two wires out, pop it in, and watch a guy do it. You know, you watch a guy do it on YouTube, and you know he kind of trailblazed for you, you know?
Yeah.
So going back to your thing, this is something that, it's something I want anybody coming up, I don't care if you're young or old or whatever, but if you're just getting at something, one of the things if you go back to your younger self and tell them something, you know, nothing like, oh, invest in Apple, you know, in Amazon. But I'm saying, if you can say something to affect your heart and your core and everything, I would have told myself, trust your instincts, chase nothing.
Interesting. Okay? Yeah.
And what I mean by that was, when I got hired by Rob Liefeld, he hired the Dan Fraga that was on his own making decisions. I was making the decisions about my style wholly from my gut.
Right.
I liked this bit of Todd. I like this bit of Art Adams. I like this bit of Rob. But I see things in a way where I'm mashing this thing together, which is my recipe.
Yeah.
Right. When I got to Extreme Studios, I was never told to do a house style. Okay. That never happened. Some people believe it did. I was never told to do a house style. But what ended up happening, though, was a bunch of us got hired, and we wanted to be like revered the most in the studio.
Sure.
So say Jeff Matsuda starts doing these cool like shines every time something would gleam, and Rob would go, man, those are really fucking cool, man. And then Chap does it, and we go, well, fuck, it looks cool on his stuff. And then I do it because, you know, and it's looking outside of yourself instead of looking inside. That's when it starts to become a chase, right? And then I found myself drawing in a style that I was like, this isn't the truth. This isn't me. And like, you know what I'm saying? And like, I spent a long time, at least the person that sits in front of you today and the way I draw, I spent a long time deconstructing all of that. Yeah, to arrive where I'm at now, because I don't ever want people to be like, oh, he was a Liefeld clone, because that happened a lot. Or he just was riffing on Art Adams, because that happened a lot, you know?
Yeah, which you can probably, I mean, it's got to be so challenging in art, because you are inspired by, or a lot of artists are, I mean, it happens in comedy too, where kind of everyone starts as a imitation of someone they like a lot. But you develop your own style over time. But it's, you know, especially when you're working in a studio at probably at a time as competitive and fast paced as the early 90s were in comic books. And like,
other studios, that was the other competition too. Like, you know, you'd see something come out of Top Cow and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Or out of, you know, Wildstorm
or something.
You know, I mean, J. Scott Campbell. He affected everybody. Everybody changed the way they drew women because of him.
Yeah.
You know, Stephen Platt, people approached the way they drew the physiques and the pushing of poses when he arrived.
Yeah.
You know, but in this studio system, this is going back to the other thing, because this is something Andy had said. In the old days when Rob, Todd, and Jim and all those guys came up, they came up where their competition was in the same building, but they were satellites amongst themselves. Rob's studio was in SoCal. Jim was in, you know, La Jolla, New York, Bay Area, depending on the time. Mark Silvestri was in Malibu, you know, and these guys, they weren't in the same room, and they were only trying to beat each other, right? My generation, which I call my generation, the guys that were basically hired by these guys.
Yeah.
And I'm not knocking Rob in any sort of way, because I love him. But there is an old adage of never outshine the master.
Sure.
You know, and when you're in a studio situation, that outshining the master, depending on who the master is, sometimes those levels, you know, put it this way. When you have... during those times, there were ways in which you could amplify someone's career or turn it down.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
And that was in the form of Wizard Magazine and Hero Magazine, because if you gave a guy an article or put him in the top 10, whatever, that's a shine, and that's a perception, you know. And that was the other thing. We were aiming, all of us were aiming to be on that top 10, but like there was so much payola and so much crazy other stuff happening that never was going to happen. It never was going to happen.
Yeah. It's just, you know, I mean, as much as I enjoyed Wizard Magazine back in the day, there's no reality to any of this stuff happening.
No.
It seems with that. But I mean, you got to think, I mean, it did mean so much there, because I mean, I know reading it, how much it influenced me and what I wanted to read, or things I, you know, if they're like, whatever, they've got this cover with something Jay Lee's doing and Hellshock, and I'm like, oh, that looks badass, you know, like
that I've was never cool.
And so you start pushing that direction. So I can imagine what a, you know, that time was so wild and, you know, exciting, but also volatile, I've got to imagine. Not necessarily, yeah, like, I mean, in personalities, but just in the industry, you know, of ups and downs, and
yeah,
with the bubble and then the kind of collapse. And
there were so many, like you said, the volatility was a lot of moving parts, you know, because for a while, the independent scene pre-image, there was an independent like explosion, right? You got the Ninja Turtles and you Mage and Sable, and like you had First Comics, Pacific Comics, Eclipse, Dark Horse, like, but they, Marvel and DC were definitely heads and tails above all of those. When Image came around, they became number three, and at a certain point I think became number two, you know, you can go passing DC. But we had a big boom too, like comics, you know, you had tons of these independents, Fly By Nights, pop up after Image. You know, it was like the, what they call it in the 80s, the black and white explosion. This was like the color explosion. But in the process, a lot of shops popped up, a lot of shops went out of business, a lot of distributors went away, you know, Heroes World gone, Capital gone, like, those are big, you know, and as a publisher, they, having several distributors allowed you to negotiate and navigate terms, because there were other
options. Yeah.
Other options. And when they went away and Diamond became sort of the monopoly, that became a different place too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, any industry, if there's just a monopoly in it, it's got to be, it's, you know, but I mean, that whole time in the mid 90s, when you're talking, you know, Image kind of had their peak and was kind of coming back down, Marvel's talking about bankruptcy, and you're like, what a wild time. And it's like, this old, you know, you're like, this whole house of cards may come down, you know, as in, it's
the comic business has always been in peril, though. That was the other thing that I realized, being sort of a thirsty for history, you know, the comic books business was in peril until the direct market came around.
Sure.
And then, you know, it was in peril again, and then something else came around, and then it was in peril again, and something else came around. But, you know, this time it's tough. It's tough because they say, you know, one of the adages is that kids don't read, you know, but the other side of that is the manga industry is thriving.
It's huge.
And you know, a lot of people want to say, well, comics are thriving, because they want to put their arm around manga and say they are. But take out the idea of, you know, Captain Underpants and Diary of a Wimpy Kid and Smile and a lot of those YA graphic novels that are not traditionally comics, and you look at it apples to apples, I feel like, and I said this on the thing with Andy, again, I keep bringing it up, but no, it was on the Professional show. I said, take a look. I wrote them down, in fact. I said, Black Hawk, Phantom, Buck Rogers, you know, Flash Gordon, Zorro, Doc Savage. Those were like mainstays. Those were like, those were the heroes of every little boy and little girl at a certain point. And right now, if I said any of those names to my kids, they would look at me with blank expressions.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder, that is the idea of Superman played out, because I look at One Punch Man, who is essentially Superman as far as his power is concerned. But the approach to it, this guy with all this power who's so bored, and every time he has to save the Earth, he's like, fine, you know, and like, that's more interesting.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, and suddenly One Punch Man, my kid wants to read that, doesn't want anything to do with Superman, because Superman is like generic, you know, I'm Superman. And Batman is like, oh, the dark brooding guy, I'd rather go, you know, take a look at, you know, Dora Hedoro, which has got dark overtones. You know what I'm saying?
Well,
so,
I mean, also, when you talk about stuff like that, you've got, especially even more so now than when I was a kid, or you were a kid, you if you want to get into Superman, you look back and be like, oh, so there's almost 100 years of continuity with this character and muck and mire, and it's been rebooted 18 times and I don't know what matter. Whereas you know, One Punch Man, you can be like, oh, I go pick up this graphic novel and I can be caught up by the end of the day.
Right.
And you know, there is something to be said about stories that have a finality too, you know, that are finite, where you
right.
can have a beginning, because there's more impact to what happens then also, you know, that there's truly impact to the character. Whereas like, well, in 14 months, someone else is just going to come back and retcon and undo this, and this person will come.
Yeah.
So
it's a difficult situation though, because the dynamic of the consumption has sort of changed. When we were kids, the comic book thing, I always kind of equate it to either a fast food restaurant or more apt, a ride, a Disneyland ride, mm-hmm. right? Like imagine Disneyland, you got the Matterhorn right here, you got the Alice in Wonderland right here, back yeah. behind you, you got the Dumbo ride. So the natural thing for you to do and pretend that the Matterhorn is comics and this over here is trading cards and this back here is Beanie Babies or whatever, right? Generally speaking, at Disneyland, someone goes and they ride a ride, they ride it and they leave, and that's that. And that ride was an experience for them. So they had it, they got in, they got out, but yeah. there was always this influx of people getting on the ride. Well, what happened with comics is not new people weren't getting on the ride. It was the same people getting on the ride over and over.
Yeah.
Right. And at a certain point they go, I love this ride. I wish the monster was scarier.
Yeah.
Right. So then the business realized, oh my God, we're not getting those new people. So we have to do something to change, but we can't throw out what got them here. We got to keep it interesting to keep the ones here. But the problem is now there's barely anybody getting on. So how do you get people to come on, satisfy the people that are on the ride?
Yeah.
You know, that's why, like, I can't read a Spider-Man now. And this, but it's always been true. I used to work for Diamond, the distributors, uh-huh. when I was like 18, right? Right before I moved to work for Image. And one of my good friends, Fred, he's about 25 years older than me, like a, you know, one of my mentors.
Yeah.
I was reading I think it was Amazing Spider-Man 319 around there. Scorpion was in it, the Rhino. And I'm like, yeah, like I'm visual. Yeah, like McFarlane, and I'm into it. And he's like chuckling. And he goes, I don't know how you can read that. And I go, what do you mean, man? It's the Spider-Man fighting the Rhinos, but yeah. Scorpion, this is badass.
This
he goes,
is it.
Do you know how many times Spider-Man has fought the Rhino and Scorpion? And I'm like, not like this. This is awesome, right? So, but then, you know, I go back and I read the Ross Andrew, the Gil Kane, the Romitas, and yeah, it has happened, like
yeah,
over and over and over again. The same thing, but in a different way, right? So now when I look at stuff, I'm like, you know,
yeah.
whatever. Like, I've seen this fight, like, you know, like as a consumer. But then they got to throw some stupid shit in, you know, like, oh, Mary Jane's, I'm making shit up. She's a clone.
Yeah.
And she's an alien. And, you know, whatever.
How long has she been a clone for? She's been an alien
since they
had a baby.
But that's how they throw the little spices in there. And it's just like, fuck, man. So yeah, it's a difficult thing. It's a difficult balance. It's like, what? And the other part of it is that in math, PEMDAS, order of operations,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you do multiplication, PEMDAS is parentheses, whatever. It's an order of operation.
Yeah.
So when we were kids, the order of operations was sort of different. Like, I bought the Spider-Man comic, which made me want the Spider-Man toy, which made me want the Spider-Man video game and anything to do with Spider-Man because of that comic.
Yeah.
Right? So let's say I go back a couple years and let's say my son Harrison has never heard of Pokemon ever, right? Never heard of it.
Yeah.
I hand him a Pokemon comic book. you know, he would look at it and be like, eh, what's this? I go, that's Pikachu. And da, da, da. I could tell him the whole thing and he'd be like, nah.
Yeah.
Right. But he started playing Pokemon when it was on the Game Boy.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
You know, the Game Boy Advance or whatever, or the DS, whatever. And then he was like, they make a playing card version of this? I'm like, yeah, hell yeah. And then he's like, wait, there's cartoons of this? Yeah. And, you know, they make a comic of it that you can read in bed. They do? Yeah. you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Pokemon the order flame of operation. Thrower.
Yeah. you know, you can get that kid, you could get that, or kid, whoever, that new reader, you can get that new reader to read a comic, but the way in which you get them to read it isn't the same as it was.
Right.
Like, you can't just be like, here's my book, read it. You almost have to have, like, some other way. Like, let's say there was, for the lack of any other example, but just use the path. Where are kids' eyes? Kids' eyes are on TikTok and they're on YouTube Reels, right? Yeah. Or so you go, okay, well, how does that relate to this? Well, you can figure out a way or create a character or create something or something to lead into that thing, which it's like a sales funnel, right? This TikTok leads to the YouTube channel. The YouTube channel leads to more time with the creator. That creator introduces you to this thing and suddenly you're all in because you like the creator that you saw on TikTok. Like the path.
Yeah, you're buying through the creative funnel instead of.
Yeah. Because your product is your product, you know. And I was teaching my daughter this, right? So, she had these little cat trading cards that she made, like just drew these little cats, and wanted to sell them when she would go to conventions with me. And one time the convention, they didn't sell. She was just like, buy my cats. And they go, oh, what are these about? Oh, these are cats I drew, da, 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 right? And I said, listen, the cats are great, everything. I said, wouldn't change your product at all.
Yeah.
I said, but let me tell you about this. And I'm just going to say, this is a rock, right? I said, I want you to buy this rock from me for $1. She's like, it's a rock, Dad. Right. And I said, okay, what if I told you that this rock has been waiting for 10 million years to meet you and that its sole purpose in the world is for you to hold it and that it is your soul rock and that no other person can have this rock but you. But in order to make that soul transition happen, I need $1. She's like, I want it.
Yeah. I'll send a little spice it up there.
Yeah, I want it. And I go, okay, now sell your brand is like a kitten adoption place. And when they get these card packs, they're adopting so-and-so. Their favorite thing is licking milk. You know, cat is such a, and when people ask you, don't say these are cats I drew, go, these are my kittens. This is so-and-so and blah, blah, blah. You can take them home and there's an adoption paper and like, and she did that and they sold out.
Yeah, all of a sudden it's unique. Right? In there.
Yeah, but it's literally the same fucking product. It's the same product. It's that.
How you get them in. That, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's, you know, that's a, it's an interesting, you know, kind of conundrum you describe here because it makes me think about, we were talking about like the movies and stuff earlier, where how when you get to like the Marvel movies, when the movies come out, they always make the comic book line try to match the movies because they want people to be able to have access to the comic book and be like,
not in the original days.
Well, not in the original days.
Dude, when you go and you see Iron Man 1 and you're like, oh my God, this is the most badass thing. I want to go buy Iron Man comics. You go in and suddenly it's Riri Williams.
Oh,
and you go and I don't care. She's a great character and I support everything that she's about. But you can't not have a comic that features Tony Stark in the comic book stores at the same time because there's a disconnect.
Yeah. Yeah.
But maybe they've changed it. You were saying they're trying to make alignments.
Yeah, every time, like, you know, it's like a movie's coming out, it's like, oh, this character gets a new series and it looks like this, or like, you know, and I feel like that started kind of, I mean, you know, when the MCU movies started, there was a little disconnect, but like when they started doing the X-Men movies, all of a sudden the X-Men books started to look like the X-Men movies. And those things, they start to blend, because you know they want the people to be like, I always describe comic books, the industry now, as like a loss leader to sell merchandise. Is basically like what the comic books are to Disney now. Like, because Disney would love to no longer print comic books monthly. Like,
yeah, the thing is they're not a loss leader, dude. They are the catalyst. They are the source. They are the catalyst, right? Like they're the raw. Like what did some? There was another analogy. A piece of iron.
Yeah.
Right. Raw iron. You go, hey, I can turn this into this raw piece of iron. I can turn it into 8 bolts, right? And sell you those bolts for a dollar piece. That piece of iron is worth $8. No, I can take that piece of iron and make 100 nails and sell them to you at this much. Oh, suddenly this piece of iron is worth 20. No, I take this piece of iron and I turn it into staples. Now it's worth $100.
Yeah.
I take this piece of iron and I turn it into surgical, very tight surgical da-da-da. Suddenly now that piece of iron is worth $20,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's that piece of iron. Comic books is that iron, right? Like we are the source of the stories, that we are the source of aesthetics. Those aesthetics get translated into merch, like you're saying, into toys, Funko Pops, T-shirts, video games, slap on the side at sliced apples. It's that raw iron. And we could be looked at as the $8, yeah, you're just bolts, you're just a chunk of iron, whatever. But it literally gets, what is done in comics literally gets parsed out and into billions.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, what I guess what I mean is that, I mean, I agree with you in what you're saying, that it is the most important part, but I feel like Disney and like these bigger corporations look at it as like, they want the IP to merchandise it. The actual monthly comic book, they're like, we don't really care about this that much. This is just like we barely make money on print comic books. But the bigger scope, what it affects, that's where they make so much money. That's what they really, really.
That's why they need to do it, though. Like I don't care if they're selling 1,000 copies of something. If the newest idea is generated by people that understand those characters, then it's way cheaper than like. The money that goes into a screenplay is a whole lot more money than goes into a year of monthly comics. Like
you could take
the screenplay, let's say the screenplay for Iron Man, and all the money that got paid to make that screenplay, which again was based on comics, but all the money that they paid for that single screenplay, they could have paid that creative team for 5 years at the rate that they get paid.
Yeah.
Right? So, but that team that could have given you 5 years of creative material, maybe the comics don't sell as much, but the ideas that came out of that are they're making
priceless. Yeah.
They're just making it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you need it. You definitely need it. It's the catalyst for everything else that comes from it. It just seems like they don't appreciate it as much as they don't look at it as that. They don't understand that this is the part that is making everything, you know?
I think you may be right.
Yeah. I mean, you're in the industry. You know what? Yeah, how much
I do. I do.
That's
why I do my own, you know?
Well, yeah, that's it. I wanted to ask you about that because, I mean, you started, you've been with the bigger company, you've worked with bigger companies. You started with Image, who was, you know, arguably the most famous company in the world at that time when you started with them.
Sure.
What was that transition like, navigating from that into the bigger two, which probably have a little bit less maybe latitude in work or in the way you can work?
It was definitely different. Like my experience, there's probably a bit of subjectivity to it where it was unique to me. There's a lot of stuff that would be ubiquitous across all people, freelancers working at the time.
Yeah.
When I started at Image, I very much felt like I was part of a family, a club, a fraternity. You know, I worked in a studio and it's all I knew. This is how comics were made, you know, and I had an understanding of how they worked at the big two, but it was different. When I started working for Marvel, it was less, I don't know if the word is touchy-feely, but less warm, less family, more mechanical and machine-like.
Did it just feel like a job at that point?
It started turning more transactional. Yeah. It was, you deliver this many pages, you turn an invoice, you get this. There wasn't a lot of like creative talks. There weren't a lot of anything. You kind of just got your thing. You were expected to deliver this stuff at a cadence. There was always that sort of unknown, like when your next gig would be, because like they would hire you and go, oh, we want you to do these three issues of blah, blah, blah. Well, what happens after that? Right. Like,
yeah.
And so you're always like, while you're doing your work, you're looking for the next one. And it was very transactional versus feeling like part of something. It was very much like a service.
Yeah.
Felt more like a service job.
What, I don't know how much you can or want to talk to this, but like, what was it like when that time when Image was kind of, and you know, Extreme also was kind of starting to fragment after their initial burst, you know, after
their... I know exactly when that was. That was 95. Yeah. And the reason I know it is I've kept a journal. Since February of 1986, I've kept a journal and like, I don't write in it every day, but I certainly write in it, whenever anything, emotionally evocative, something eventful of note, child's birth, you know, whatever, this happened, got a new gig or my basement flooded or whatever, you know, just this sort of thing. And I remember the hardest part is that there was massive growth, and I can only speak for Extreme because that's where I was.
Sure.
And at the time I was 22, right? So massive growth. We went from a very small, when I came in, the studio consisted of Rob, of course, Richard Horry, who was like, he did an assistant on like backgrounds, like weapons and things. Marat Michaels, who was another artist.
Yeah.
George McCarthy, who did like transfers. Rob would do these little layouts and then they would blow them up on the copy machine. George would go over on a light box and transfer Rob's layout.
Okay.
Lightly in pencil so Rob could work on it full size. So he was there. And then the guys that came in to visit a lot that were like part of the studio but like went home and did their shit were Jim Valentino and Brian Murray. So then when we moved studios, and this is when it went from North Barry, this was February of 92 when Image was announced and CNN was there. I had visited. This was when I was scouting this, and this is when they were at North Barry. By the time I moved there, the following month in March of 92, they had moved to a place on Nutwood in Fullerton. It was across from Cal State Fullerton. And that's when we began to staff up. We hired Norm Ratman, the inker, Danny Mickey.
Mm-hmm.
Shannon was our receptionist. Chap Yape, he was one of the guys I found. Chap. Came in as another penciler, then Chuck Jones. And all the people that were in that first Extreme Studios tour book.
Yeah.
You know, those were the guys. Because Jeff Matsuda, we met up with him in Chicago of 93. So he wasn't even in that first tour book. So then we had another phase 94-ish, where Rob was just like on a hiring frenzy, right? We hired John Sabal, Marlo Alkiza, Anthony Wynn, Larry Stuckert, Shannon Denton, Scott Sirach, Edwin Rochelle, Mark Pacella. We brought in some other guys, the established guys, Dan Panosian, Art DeBear, colorists, Byron Tallman, Chris Leitner, created the digital color, Extreme Color, which there weren't a lot of digital color houses, so we staffed up back there. We also brought in editorial in the form of Eric Stevenson, and then an in-house letterer with Kurt Hathaway, and all of the assistants and PAs, and this is like 94. By 95, it was even more, but suddenly the numbers started to drop, and Rob had to scale back, right? And what I wrote in my journal, and this was the real hard part about being on Rob's inside circle, is there were a lot of things, a lot of insider baseball things I knew, people's futures that I knew for weeks. It was like, what did I say? It was like a dead man walking, you know, like it was a hard thing to keep inside, because it's like, I like these people, but I also know they're going to get let go next week.
Right.
You know, and for me, that chewed me up a little bit. Like, I wish I didn't know, but I also knew that why I wasn't supposed to say it. You know what I'm saying?
Like, especially because, like, if you're working in a collaborative situation and, you know, they start talking about future projects and you're like,
Yeah. So I remember I wrote in my journal. It was one of those things where, it had evoked a need to write in my journal about how heavy that situation felt.
Sure, because like you said, they feel like friends and family. It feels like,
we went into sort of a different era, which was the Maximum Press era.
Yeah.
And that was around the time that Rob and it was the impetus of when Rob and Image had split.
Yeah.
And what had happened in that situation, you know, the Image guys will say their different reasons of, Rob was trying to steal talent, right? You know, that was one coming from Silvestri, because he was trying to get Michael Turner to do some work, but he wasn't trying to steal him away. And, you know, and Mike was a friend of mine, and I could almost be the one to take blame, because I'd be like, oh, dude, it'd be cool to see you do, you know, just sort of off the cuff, not we're actively trying to steal you.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't
want to work with Michael Turner at the time?
You know, and then there was the whole thing about, because our offices were next door to the Image offices, we could see what other people were working on, and they felt like that was like espionage, right?
Interesting.
What, you know?
Yeah.
But the absolute real reason, and it was something that they were upset about, and it's always this way, is it boiled down to money. And the reason, I will give a sort of a detailed explanation of that, in that the Image deal, as it is now and as it was then, the way the mechanics work is that the Image office, the infrastructure to talk to printers and distributors, the Image office, Image Central, the hub of everybody, was paid for through a portion of each book that went through the office.
Yeah.
And it was a flat fee. Per issue, not per title, per issue. So issue one, issue two, issue three, issue four. It was $2,500. And it's the same thing now. Like when I did Gear Station, you put in $2,500. And what that $2,500 gets you is all of the bells and whistles of a publisher that takes care of you. All you got to do is draw it and submit it. They talk to the printers. They talk to the distributors. That $2,500. And it also works as a bank loan, because they're paying the printer in advance for you before you get your check.
Yeah.
So they cut that out and they cut the 25 out, you get paid. That's how it has always worked. Now, Todd McFarlane was doing one book. Eric Larson was doing one book. Silvestri was doing, I think, 3 or 4 books.
Yeah.
And Jim Lee was doing like 10 books. Rob was doing 25 books. And when you start doing the math and you go, well, gee, Todd, every month you contribute $2,500. Whereas Rob is contributing,
you know,
$25,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
In my math, terrible math right now, but yeah, you know, 2,500 times 25. So when Rob decided to start doing books, Maximum Press,
right,
those were books he was putting out outside of the image eye that didn't have to chip in.
Yeah.
And the other image owner saw that as that is creating competition for ourselves. So now we're competing with a company outside of your company. Like,
yeah,
they got really upset about that, but they also got upset that those books weren't putting in.
Yeah, they weren't getting a piece of that. Yeah,
so that happened, and so then Rob formed some alliances with a guy named Scott Rosenberg, another guy named John Hyde, and like, this is all fuzzy to me, but that's where you got Awesome Comics and Arcade Comics and all of that. But that was generally like the tipping point path of things.
Yeah. I always wondered, because I mean, I remember reading at that point, I was a fan reading all that stuff from Image, and then this Maximum Press comes out, you know, you hear stories, and it's just such an interesting of like, you know, when you are a guy who is one of the heads of Image to create another imprint to do stuff. And but now that 100% that totally makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
And that it always interested me too, the infrastructure of a company that was kind of spearheaded by six guys making decisions about how that would run. It just seems like there's going to be challenges down the road, which obviously,
I mean, it was utopian, like a Camelot thing at first, because it made sense. The image as a company owned nothing except for the trademark of the image eye. Like, that was literally it. The company owned that and that alone. And there was no outside interference. You couldn't say, Jim couldn't say to Rob, you can't do this in your studio, or you have to set these rates. Nobody could tell the other person what to do. The only thing that was uniquely shared was the image eye and that sort of hub to get, you know, everybody else. It was like satellites.
Yeah.
Go to this hub. This hub allowed all of the communication between the distributors through, not even conventions, just the manufacture and distribution of the books. That's it.
Yeah.
That's all Image did, is they facilitated. So it ultimately was a good thing. But then, you know, Todd was getting mad about late books, and, you know, and Eric was getting mad about, you know, other stuff. And like, at the end of the day, those are all strong minded individuals.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. That's what got them there in the first place.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's gotta be, like you said, utopian in theory, and then, you know, I mean, obviously it's still panned out long term as a success, but
it's unrecognizable to me, man.
I would imagine. I mean, what is, if any, your relationship with that now?
I have no relationship with it other than I helped build it, you know, like, you know, the books I worked on and the things that we did earlier on helped build that company. And you know, the last time I had any dealings with them was when I signed a contract with them, in 2000, when I did Gear Station. Mm-hmm. And, I was told that I had a, deal with them in perpetuity, of that I can bring anything over there that I want to, and that the deal is the same deal, the $2,500 deal and all of that. So I felt like I always had a place to go to.
Yeah.
Valentino then became the publisher. I left comics for a while. Then I did my sort of like a self, like a, I did everything on this thing called The Grave, which was just like my project where I did a panel a day. And I thought, hey, what if I compiled these and put out a book? So I was like, yeah, I'm going to go home. You know, I'm going to reach out to Image and say, hey, I'd like to start putting this together. And I was told that I had to go through the submission process like anybody else, right?
Yeah.
So that was the first time, and I was like, but wait, like I'm.
Yeah, you know, we've done this. This is.
I was here before you were. Like, let's say that. Okay, yeah. That's number one. I was here. Like, just take that. I was here before you. I remember your first day, dude. So, like, let's get that out of the way. Number two, I have a deal that I signed with Larry Martyr in 2000 that says I can bring my book here and Image will print it. And I was basically told that's null and void. That was a different regime, and that all of those agreements are null and void.
Wow.
Right. And I was like, wow, then what good is a contract? Right. And they said, we'll just submit it. So I submitted it. And I heard nothing. I wrote Eric Stevenson again and said, hey, like, dude, this makes no sense to me. Like, you know, I started at Image before Image was Image. I worked there and I was there the day they launched. And like, dude, I'm part of Image's history. Why wouldn't you do this? And he's like, I'm very busy. I'll get to it when I get to it. And he never got to it.
Damn. Wow.
Right. So it's just one of those, like, I go, it's not home anymore, dude. It's great memories. I'm very proud to have been part of it, but it's absolutely the past.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, maybe, and I don't know, you know, obviously you being in the industry, it's maybe that's indicative of just the industry as a whole, is where, you know, it used to be warmer and more collaborative and more of a, you know, fun. We want to make these stories. And now, again, keep going back to this corporation thing, but it just kind of is a machine. We just need to, you know, very editorially driven, very corporate driven, instead of, you know, we're trying to make these great creative stories and have, you know, collaborations and, you know, really an art.
Yeah. Well, the way I see it, and a lot of people I know, the way they see it is that, much like the way comics changed when the direct market helped change comics, the advent of crowdfunding is changing the way the customer, the fan, gets their books.
Yeah.
And the way in which they are marketed, and, you know, all of that has changed. So at the end of the day, the reins are back in the creator's hands.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me to try to say this is how you fix the old way is like, what did King Solomon say in Ecclesiastes? He said, chasing the wind.
Yeah.
it's chasing the wind. Sure. Like there's no point to it. What we need to understand, and this is what happened, was that it should always, always, always be about the person that experiences, and I'm going to call it the product, even though that is a cold way, but we're just going to give it a noun of the product, because for me, it's way more than a product. But the only thing that matters is the feeling that the person ingesting your product receives. And this is my personal opinion. But I remember as a kid opening certain comics and just losing my breath, or like that comic I had mentioned, you know, Spider-Man 319, with the Rhino and Scorpion, just that, oh, whoa, like when you turn the page, that like, oh yeah, my gosh, yeah,
get you.
That is all that matters, is that person's emotional response. That is all that I am selling. That is what I'm selling. The way in which I do it is through my comic book, right? But that is my, that way out there is my target.
Yeah.
The problem though is that the publisher has shareholders. The shareholders, they want dollars.
Right.
The publisher puts it on their editorial, we need units sold, okay? That trickles down from the publisher to the retailer. We need you to buy units, right? And the publisher and the retailer to keep afloat, because his whole thing is he wants to make sure that he can facilitate doing this
as a building
is to sell as many as he can of this thing. But the person that gets left out, though, is that feeling of that customer, because the emphasis is on the sale and the dollar. So you get crazy shit. Like, for example, I went into my retailer, great guy, Cliff Biggers. He did Comic Shop News, great store in Marietta called Dr. Knows. I go in there. I'm looking for, because I was told about it. I had no idea it was an incentive cover, none of that, right? I was like, hey, do you have the da-da-da cover? And he's like, no, we only got two. And I said, well, why? He goes, well, you got to buy 100 to get one. So I had to buy 200 to get those two covers, and they sold immediately. And basically, and I go, oh, shoot. I go, how much did they go for? He's like, oh, those covers go for like 75 each, you know? And I go, oh. He goes, yeah, and I kind of got to do it because the money that I make from those two covers helps pay for these 200 books that sit on my shelf.
Yeah.
Right? And he goes, of those 200, I might sell 75 of them, but then there's all these other ones that sit there. Guess who's happy? The distributor's happy because they made their 5% off each one sold. The public or the editorial's happy because they did numbers. And the publisher's happy, and because they can show those numbers to the shareholders. The only person that isn't really happy is the retailer, and at the end of the day, the fan, because right. they didn't get that cool cover, and the emphasis wasn't even put there for them. They weren't looking.
They
for
weren't
that.
Considered in the equation.
Yeah. So the beauty of crowdfunding is number one, and you and I talked a little bit about this before we started up, but like being sort of self-aware and being authentic in that you can see your work from the audience's point of view, and the only way you can truly do that is to be a fan.
Yeah.
To be a fan yourself. So when I'm working on my stuff, I have to be tickled by it. Like I have to, like when I'm done, I want to be like, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I know if I have done that, when the 16-year-old Dan Frege is going, yeah, you know, like I remember where I was when I cracked Spider-Man 300, you know, with Mary Jane all hiding and huddling. Yeah. And I remember where I was. I was walking to school and I literally stopped and I read like the first 10 pages standing on my way to school. I couldn't even walk. Like, can you imagine a piece of literature that can do that? You know, like it's the truth of it is when done right, it's literal magic, yeah. right? Like I'm not a big fan of Neil Gaiman's work, but I like a lot of what he says. And someone had asked him about, do you believe in magic? Like, do you believe in magic? He said, well, whether I believe in magic or not, he said, the fact that I, a stranger, could put characters on a piece of paper that then get made into more pieces of paper that someone 5,000 miles away from me can read and it makes them cry, I don't know what else you could call it other than magic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Like that, it's for real.
That's
like,
a very, yeah, I mean, that's very powerful. I mean, it seems like a wild thing to say, but when you think about it, that is, how else could you describe that?
Right,
it's very powerful.
Right. So that's like, to me, I go that response that coming out of your chest, like, oh, or when you see something cool, whether it's, you know, you said you were into motorcycles. Like, I like watching the drone footage of people doing crazy tricks.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes when they're catching air and the drone is kind of doing a counter move as they're rising, I get that roller coaster going over the hill feeling that, like, you go, oh,
you got to catch your breath.
That's awesome.
A little bit.
You know? Yeah. Well, if I can do that with, you know, with this and a piece of paper and, you know, it goes off into the wild, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
But I have to, goes back to what we were saying, I have to believe it. The customer is the only reason, and crowdfunding and doing it through streaming and the thing I was talking about, getting people's eyes on you, whether it's through TikTok, Instagram, yeah. YouTube, or whatever, that is the new way. The old way is horse and buggy. The new way is the automobile. We're both trying to get you from point A to point B, but one is a little more effective.
Efficient, yeah. Well, and it's such a great thing because it does give people direct source to the creators. You know, I mean, the idea of trying to get direct link to a creator of something I liked when I was younger was insane. You know, I mean, there was no, right. I was sitting in a fucking hole in Eastside Long Beach and I couldn't, I mean, who knows? We didn't have the internet, you know?
Right.
I could write right. something on a piece of paper and throw it in the mail if I can find the mailing address, but how do I even look that up? And, you know,
right.
it's like, where now you can, you know, like, I mean, I reached out to you via Facebook, you know? I mean, that's, yeah. Yeah, that's something you can do. And then you can follow the people you like very specifically and very much invest in what they're doing in their art. And that yeah. connection, I think, is really important. And those are the type of things that are going to keep the industry going, I feel like. And it's kind of the only way.
It's got a bit of a double-edged sword to it, though. And this was something else that that I talked about with the guys on the professional show, is that with this new sort of way of doing things, there belays one problem, and what that is I know a lot of guys that are incredibly talented that can draw their ass off and draw fast and make good work that are bumps on a wall. They don't want to hold a conversation. Yeah. They certainly don't want to be on camera. They just want to make their books.
Yeah.
They just want to draw their pictures and they just want to sell them. That's the person that is going to have a hard time. It's the video killed the radio star sort of situation.
Yeah. You know,
I've been doing live TV since high school. So I've always felt absolutely comfortable in front of a camera with a microphone because it just is.
Yeah.
But I know other people, you put a camera on them and they
freeze.
they you know, Mitch McConnell style.
Right. Bro, yeah. Like, they freeze out.
Yeah. Their hardware just fails. But then you go, okay, well, maybe there's a new model where those people get helped.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I want, at the end of the day, I just want to be entertained too. I want good comics. I want good stuff. I get inspired. I see guys out there, Daniel Warren Johnson, James Heron, Eric Canetti. These guys are doing stuff that I'm just like, this is awesome, you know. And if we you don't know if the next guy out there may be shy, very shy, yeah. guy or girl, very shy, and the world doesn't get to know their awesomeness because of that.
Yeah. You like to hope that in that scenario they get hooked up with people who maybe can help promote yeah. and push them forward at that point,
yeah.
you know, like a, yeah. whether it's a writer or another artist or another, you know, some creative collaboration that, you know, can link people up. And, you know, cause you have these, you know, people doing stuff on Substack, you have this new distillery thing that just came out last week with, it's a new comic imprint with all these artists, you know, writers and artists who are kind of putting out their own stuff.
Oh, I think I saw some Facebook ads, but it's not spelled distillery. It's like yeah, D something.
It's missing, I think, all the vowels or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah. I've seen that. The branding is like purple and white.
Yep.
Or,
yeah.
Okay. It's so weird. It's like, I don't know what you're talking about, but then right. my brain is yeah. like remembering all the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Facebook is working. Yeah. The subliminal ads are working on you, Dan.
Yeah. For real.
So, you know, and stuff like that where it's like, yeah, some people in that, you know, network probably aren't the guy who's could do it on their own, but because they kind of have this little,
they need a Stan Lee.
Yeah. Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, for lack of a better phrase, if there the was Carnival somebody Barker. Out there going, you know, going, oh, believe in, you know, like an umbrella company, you know, mm-hmm. like I have incredible comics, right? So what if, I'm not saying I'm going to do this, so this is a hypothetical, but what if some of these people don't want to be on YouTube? But I can sell their book,
yeah.
you know, like there's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
but that also takes a lot of, you know, under, you know, behind the scenes, that stuff's hard because then you end up having to, like, you know,
some sort of partner, some say, yeah, you gotta, there's paperwork involved.
Yeah, exactly.
Can hurt feelings, you know.
Yeah. And that's, or the avoidance of hurt feelings by making sure that the paperwork involved is airtight.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the it's one of those things too where I always say that, you know, it's kind of like that quote out of Batman, you know, you either die a hero, live long enough to see yourself become the villain. But it's like, it seems like if everyone's around long enough, eventually everyone becomes the man, you know?
Right.
Like you got to worry about that aspect of it.
Yeah, it's tough. Right. Heavy is the crown, they say, but at the end of the day, you know, we're making comics and making, you know, trying to make, in your case, making people laugh. Laughter is powerful.
Trying.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. We've been, let me see. We're cranking on 2 hours here. Okay. I don't want to keep you all day, Dan, but,
good. Yeah. I'm going to eat some lunch here.
Yeah. Soon. Why don't you tell us, you know, what do you got, cooking right now that you're working on? I know you did, you were doing a lot of directing, storyboarding, stuff like that for, you know, kind of out of comic books. What do you have coming up?
Yeah. Working my day job. I'm not really allowed to say, what it is, but you know, I've been directing a TV show. An animated show, so okay. It's, you know, outside, thank goodness it's outside of the strikes and such.
Oh yeah.
And then working on my book during the mornings. I wake up at 4:30 every morning, go to the gym, spend my first half of the day working on my book called Black Flag. You can find that on Indiegogo. Just search for in Google, search for Fragaboom Black Flag. It'll take you to IndieCron. Once you go to IndieCron, click on that link and you'll be able to see it. Working on that, working on the animated show, and then, you know, being a dad, father of four, husband of one, you know.
How retro of you, just a husband of one.
I know, so weird.
So old school.
So weird.
Well, I gotta say, I appreciate the fact that you going back to the Black Flag, you know. I mean, that's probably where I was, one of the places, at least early on, introduced to you.
If we've got 9 years between us, I created Black Flag in 94. I was 21, so you would have been 10.
I mean,
sorry, 12.
I remember buying it off the shelf. So
yeah,
I
was making that comic for you, dude. Yeah,
thank you. I read it again. I still got some. Oh, that box right there.
That's
it's
awesome.
Still in there. So
you know, do you know the artist Ryan Stegman?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. He and I met for the first time at Terrificon in 2019, and he's like, "Black Flag was the first comic I ever bought," and I was just like, "What?" Yeah, I'm like, "You're Ryan Stegman, bro. That's crazy." Like, you know, thinking about that. Like, but then. Then again, it's really like, I always tell people if I was to say get knocked unconscious and be in a hospital bed with amnesia, right? And someone said to you, do you know your name? I'd go, no. But if they go, how old are you? I'd say, I'm 33. Like that's what I would say.
Yeah.
Because that's it, like deep in here, I really believe
right,
I'm 33. I'm 50,
right?
I'm 50, but so when people come up to me and like, especially at a show and they've got an adult quote unquote kid with them, they go, oh, this is my son, blah, blah, blah. He's, you know, going to college, he's 20 something. Yeah, oh man, I loved your stuff when I was a kid. This is the dad saying, oh man, I loved your stuff when I was a kid. I look up at him and I'm like,
yeah, wait a second. Yeah.
No. And then I go, yeah. How old are you? And they're like, oh, you know, I'm you know, 46. And I go, oh, well, that makes sense because I drew Bloodstrike when I was 18 and 19. So someone that was 14 is a kid.
Yeah.
But in my mind, I was already a pro.
Right.
So there's that disconnect. Even though it's only 5 years, it's nothing.
Yeah.
Right. It's still. But then to think, like, I started 32 years ago.
Oof, yeah.
That doesn't make sense to me either because I'm 33.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's a weird, nebulous first few years of your life.
Oh, it's just so weird. And also, like, recounting this stuff, It very much feels like telling somebody about a movie I saw.
Sure.
Because it was such a lifetime ago.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like 33 years, it seems, or 32 years, it seems. Yeah, because, I mean, I start thinking about stuff that I'm like, oh, yeah, that was not that long ago. I'm like, oh, no, that was 1998. And you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, this was, you know, but it just, the older you get, time gets so nebulous because it just seems,
oh, man,
like not real, but also you lived it a million times.
And it's also my buddy Brian Murray and I, we were talking about this, about the construct of time and the truth that we think exists is that time, relativity, and perception are all interlinked.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, take my 4-year-old, right? She has lived on this world 4 years. Half of her lifetime is 2 years. Her lifetime. So half of all she's ever experienced and how she perceives life is 2 years. 2 years to me, I farted 2 years ago. I remember that.
Yeah. You know,
like it was nothing. It was like it that was last week, because it's only, you know, 1/25th of my life.
Right. It's a sliding scale
for yeah. sure. Yeah. So, and the way we perceive it, and my dad, who's 80, he is confirmed to me. He said, son, it doesn't stop. He says, you know, because you meet old people sometimes and they go, well, what day is it? You go, it's the third. No. Is it Thursday? Is it yeah. Saturday? And you go, how could you not know? Right. Oh, I get it now. Like, especially when it's going that fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you've lived a million at that point.
Yes.
You had a million. You know, well, it's like I always say, when I was a kid, I felt like in between birthdays was a decade in between every birthday. But now it's like I blink and it's another birthday because I've had so many of them. You know, when you're only 10, you're like, I only remember 5 of these damn things. You know,
right.
Like they say I've had a few before, but
yeah.
And now it just keeps on rolling. So
yeah,
I don't know. We're not getting any younger, but that's all right. Dan, we'll let you get out of here for the day. I appreciate you being here again. Shout out any social media where people can follow you again, find you, support the book.
Oh,
and
man,
everything.
I'm all over the place. Just the keywords that you search are couch doodle, couchdoodles, and fragaboom, fragaboom. Those are basically the two keywords that you'll find me.
All right.
Using those, I'm on Instagram. I'm on X. I'm on TikTok. I'm on YouTube. I'm on, I think I said Instagram.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm all over the place. But those are the two tags to search for. And then again, like I said, Fragaboom's Black Flag. It'll take you to IndieCron, and IndieCron will take you to Indiegogo.
All right. Well, guys, go support. If you haven't ever checked out the comic book, check it out. And all the things that Dan does, he directs shows and all sorts of stuff. So you can get all the information and support. And appreciate you being here, man. This was fun. So,
thank you. I had a good time. Hopefully I can come back.
Yeah, let's do it again, man. Anytime. Right. I'd love to. I'm sure we could obviously talk for hours. There's more. We barely even touched the surface. So, but as for me, guys, go to deescomedy.com. Check out everything going on across the network. I will be in the Northwest all September. So check out dates on the calendar. I've got shows in Montana, Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and doing stuff. So come check me out at a show. Tickets are selling. And that's it. All right, guys. For the social, I've been Deese, and for Dan Fraga, thank you very much, guys. And we will see you all next week. All right, and we are...